Despite the low temperatures, it's really worth it. And so what I want to talk about today, well, is this stuff. And in particular, if you look at the second part of the title, you would say, OK, I have a brain in compactified space. It's sort of obvious that I should get 4D gravity. You know, you have low energy effective theory that is 4D gravity. Well, that is a 4D theory, and typically you expect to get 4D gravity. And what I would try to argue is that, well, first of all, as usual, after you get the result, it's always obvious that it is what you expected to be. But it actually takes quite a little bit of work to get to this standard 4D gravity. And there are several subtleties you have to take into account before getting to this almost obvious result. So this talk is based on a paper written, I realized today, 1 year ago, with Marco Pelosa and Massimo Casinato. It was an international Italian collaboration. And So let me start with a general introduction. Well, brain models, and again, it's almost 10 years ago, emerged with the main motivation that was coming from particle physics. It was a new alternative solution to the hierarchy problem, either with the largest dimensions or with more compactification. That was the original motivation. But it turned out that they, actually, these models ended up being very interesting for what concerns their gravity behavior. And some reason is, again, it could be expected, because the main difference between brain models and standard four-dimensional theories is the fact that gravity behaves differently. And they have generated a huge amount of papers, and in particular, they've even generated one subfield that is what is known today as brain cosmology. So all these things came out of the motivation from particle physics, but went in completely new directions. And as I will repeat several times in this talk, the fact that you have basically different communities at work, particle physics community and general relativity community, sometimes generates some either incomprehension or some results that are well known by one community that take 20 years to migrate to the other community. Particular, for the first several years, people have been working mostly with codimension one brain models. There's a couple of reasons for that. Well, first of all, codimension one is easy, or necessarily easier than codimension two, that in turn is easier than codimension three, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And second, because of, in particular, Randall-Sandrum model, and in particular, especially Randall-Sandrum two model, the one with only one brain, that doesn't need any stabilization mechanism for the extra dimension, because the extra dimension is in coordinates infinitely extended, or in any case, is compactified, if you want, just by a regular horizon of the brain that is effectively accelerating. And of course, you don't depend on all the model dependence of the stabilization mechanism, so you can just ignore the issue and study everything in great detail for this Randall-Sandrum model. So people have been working a lot on codimension one brains. But, of course, brain models can have more than one extra dimension. And in particular, if you look at the ADD scenario, two extra dimensions is the minimal number of large extra dimensions that you can afford if you want to solve the hierarchy problem, or at least address it to some extent. What I will argue during this talk is that two extra dimensions is interesting not only because of Arcadian-Penzias modulus and Valli, but also because of other specific reasons. So since two dimension one is so well studied, I will forget about it for during all of this hour, and I will go to the next step, that is the study of two dimension two brain. So let us start by a simple case, that is just gravity in 2+1 dimensions. So this is, if you want, is the simplest codimension two, in which instead of considering a brain, I consider just a zero brain particle in 2+1 dimensions. So gravity in 2+1 dimensions has this nice and interesting feature that it's a non-dynamical theory. What does it mean? It means that just because of counting of degrees of freedom and counting of number of indices, the Riemann tensor is actually proportional to the Einstein tensor. Now, the Einstein tensor is not zero only in presence of matter. As a consequence, you have curvature only where there is no matter. In other words, if I add this object in 2+1 dimensions, there will be some curvature inside the object, but nothing will be present outside of the object. If I'm sitting outside of the object and I have the most wonderful gravity wave detector, I will not detect anything. Or the best gravity gravitational field detector, I will not detect anything. If I wave the object, no gravity waves will go out of the air. So by local measurements, if I just sit far from the object and I do measurements just close to myself, I will not be able to tell that the object is there. However, of course, something has to happen. And what happens is that, well, in the simplest case of a point like mass M, it's possible to solve Einstein equations in 2+1 dimensions. And as I said, the metric is just the one of flat space outside of the source. It cannot be anything else. But there is an effect at the level of topology. This angle, theta, does not range between 0 and 2 pi, as usual, but it ranges between 0 and 2 pi, 1 minus some quantity that depends on M, the mass of the particle. This quantity is known as deficit angle, beta, and the geometric interpretation of this is that if I put a particle in the origin of my two-dimensional space, the effect of the particle is basically to cut away a bad wedge of an angle beta from your space and then identify the two sides. So that if I am allowed to think of extracting this picture from the screen, what I have is actually the geometry of a cone with the particle located at the tip of the cone. So in very analogous way, a three brain in a six-dimensional bulk has exactly the same effect. In first approximation, it doesn't curve the bulk. So the six-dimensional space stays locally flat, but it generates this deficit angle. Now, of course, it's much more difficult to visualize this thing since we are thinking of six dimensions, but this is basically what happens. You have a curvature singularity at the tip of the cone. This curvature singularity is matched by the singular stress energy tensor associated to the brain. The brain is associated to some, in particular, with some tension. And you have a relationship, a fixed relationship between the deficit angle and the tension of the brain. So bottom line, because of this reason, one thing that is interesting is that no matter what's the tension of the brain, it's possible to find solutions where the brain is flat, and the different values of the tension of the brain basically offload their effects in the bulk by just changing the how much the cone is open. Okay? So because of this reason, in particular, because of the fact that it's possible to get a flat brain, so the four-dimensional effective theory turned out to have a Minkowski section for any value of the brain tension, some people started wondering if this can help with the cosmological constant problem. And in particular, people started considering the possibility of applying the so-called self-tuning mechanism in this scenario. So what's the self-tuning mechanism, first of all? Self-tuning mechanism is a partial resolution of the cosmological constant problem. The idea is I still accept that there is some fine-tuning in the theory, but I try to find out that this fine-tuning, I try to impose that this fine-tuning doesn't depend on the particle content of your theory. In first approximation, what we usually think of the cosmological constant problem is that we should expect to have a very large cosmological constant due to the quantum fluctuations of particles in the standard model. And since there is no reason why these energies of these quantum fluctuations should cancel with each other, we expect typically these energies to be at least as large as the scales that we have probed today. So we would expect a vacuum energy of the order of the TeV to the fourth, typically, at least. And of course, what you observe is much smaller than that. The idea of self-tuning is the following. Suppose that matter lives only on the brain, in which case you have actually the vacuum fluctuations on the brain are of the order, lead to an energy that is of the order of TeV to the fourth. However, the only effect of this brain tension is actually to close the cone in the bulk. And I keep having a brain that is flat. So my solution keeps looking like Minkowski space. So that is the idea of the self-tuning. There are several incarnations and several attempts of self-tuning solution. And as I will argue, none of them works up now. Not that I'm afraid, aware, at least. And the point is, in this case, the problem is that, well, everything I say up to now was fine. The only problem is that I'm living with a six-dimensional space that is infinitely extended. I have my cone that opens all the way to infinity. So I still don't get 4D gravity from the brain. In order to get 4D gravity from the brain, I'd better compactify the extra space. If this extra space goes out to infinity, I will expect in general to see six-dimensional gravity from the brain. And of course, this is in this agreement with observation. So a more realistic setting is the following. So since the problem now is compactification, yes?
Before you're going to try to get 4D gravity, so what if you have a phase transition in which the tension would effectively change in time?
In this scenario, yeah. Without compactification, you have just that the cone opening changes.
It adjusts.
Yeah, it adjusts. In that case, it just adjusts. As long as you don't have anything else. Now, what I want to argue is that you have to add something else because otherwise your space is infinite.
So, excuse me, yeah. If you need to realize inflation on your brain, then what will you do?
A lot of problems. I agree. That's a typical objection to the self-tuning mechanism, and there's no real answer to that. Well, one answer can be the following. Inflation has to last 60 e-folds. So maybe it's a kind of transient before you self-tune to another situation. But I'm waving my hands, and this is, I think, the typical answer you get to this kind of problems. So incidentally, going to back, in this case, as I said, in any case, you have to have some fine-tuning. And in this case, the fine-tuning that I'm imposing is that the bulk cosmological constant is zero. But again, I can always argue that there is some miracle that happens, like supersymmetry in the bulk, by which the bulk cosmological constant is kept equal to zero, and all horrible things happen only in the brain. So as I said, what we have to do is to compactify. So this is probably the simplest mechanism, and for sure a very, very elegant mechanism of compactification of two extra dimensions. We're talking about two extra dimensions. This was first proposed by Freund and Rubin in 1980. Actually, it was an arbitrary number of dimensions, but it works very well in our case. And then reanalyzed a couple of years later by Salam and Zelfin. And the matter content, now forget about brains. Think just about the theory where you have just a cosmological constant, lambda, and a U1 gauge field, FMN. And you have an action that is just a simplest one you can write down using this ingredient in six dimensions. It's possible to show that it's possible to find a solution where you have a solution that is four-dimensional Minkowski space times a sphere by imposing these conditions, that there is a magnetic field only in the theta phi direction, where theta phi are the two coordinates that I'm using to parameterize the internal sphere. So I have a magnetic field here that basically generates a flux in this compact sphere. And I tune the strength of the magnetic field against the bulk cosmological constant. And in six dimensions, lambda has mass dimension 6, b has mass dimension 3, so the dimensions are fine. You have this fine-tuning, and once you impose this fine-tuning, you get that the sphere is stabilized to some radius that is of this order of magnitude, where n is the fundamental flux scale in six dimensions. And this has been known for many, many years, and people have analyzed the stability, the state is stable, etc. Now, suppose that I put two brains at the two poles. The fact, as I said, locally, is just to change the angle at the pole, so that the flat space, the flat section in the pole now becomes the cone. So effectively, I put in two brains here, and I need to put two in order to have the right number of angles in such a way that topologically the thing makes sense. I put one brain here and one brain here, and the effect, as I said, is as before to cut the wedge of your space and identify these two things. And the result is this football or rugby compatification. So you have two brains and the two tips, or if you don't like having two brains that have exactly the same properties, you can always take for just one brain and Z2 symmetry at the equator. And the shape is exactly the one of the football. And again, you generate a deficit angle beta at the North Pole and the South Pole. And this is the value of beta, again, is related to the tension of the brain. I'm assuming for the time being that the brain carries only tension in units of the fundamental plane mass. Notice one interesting property of gravity in two dimensions. You have a maximum mass that you can put in two dimensions. If this angle beta, of course, cannot exceed one, if it exceeds one, your space disappears. So this is one of the nice properties of two dimensions that, of course, do not carry over to three dimensions. Okay, so now the idea is the following. Now, suppose that we have a phase transition on the brain. Changing the brain tension has only the effect of changing the deficit angle. I still get flat 4D solution when I change the tension of the brain. And I can argue that I am alleviating, if not solving, the cosmological constant problem. I have still a fine-tuning in the bulk. In this case, it's the fine-tuning of bulk cosmological constant against magnetic field. But then I don't care about what is on the brain. And it's already making the cosmological constant better.
Can I ask you, sorry, so are the brains the monopoles for this B field?
At this level, no. But I will go there in 1 second. At this level, there are no monopoles. Actually, they will need to be. Okay, so, well, question is the cosmological constant alleviated this way? And of course, I'm asking the answer is no. And the reason why not is just that I want to have a sensible four-dimensional effective theory with a bunch of scalar fields, not too many, and Einstein gravity. Automatically, this means that I want to have, and in this scenario, I actually should have just Einstein gravity at low energies, and with a four-dimensional effective theory, few scalar fields, and so I can apply the Noether theorem from Weinberg. That says that there is no set, well, no automatic tuning solution to the cosmological constant problem. So there is something that has to go wrong in this scenario. So what goes wrong? Well, people immediately, this idea was first, well, I forgot to mention, this idea was put forward in this explicit way by Sean Carroll and Monica Guica in 2003. But actually, if one goes back in the literature, you can find the paper. And again, it's a matter of different communities not necessarily talking to each other. Paper by Ramana Sundrum in 1998, where many of these ideas and many of these problems are already discussed. And it's just written in particle physics language. And the more GR-ish people didn't read it. And so the first problem that people realized was the following. So you have this bulk magnetic field. What happens is that this bulk magnetic field is associated to some vector potential. If you require the vector potential to be regular at the two poles, north and south, it turns out that this vector potential cannot be continuous. Either it's regular at the north pole or it's regular at the south pole. Of course, that's not really a problem because you can also have something that is regular both at the north pole and at the south pole. It's not continuous, but the north part is related to the south part by a Gauss transformation. But then you have to require that this Gauss transformation is single valued. In particular, single valued when you go around the sphere. So in particular, if you have bulk matter that is charged under this U1 field, and is charged with some electric charge E, it turns out that you have a condition that of quantization that ends up being a condition of quantization of the deficit angle. And the deficit angle has to be proportional to this number N, that can be 0, 1, 2, 1 million, 2 million, but an integer, and to this quantity. So bottom line is the tension can take only a discrete set of values. And this makes already the mechanism much less appealing, of course, because there's no reason, or it seems strange, that cosmological constant cannot take any possible value, but only a discrete set of values. Of course, if this quantity 1 over beta is very, very small, you can have a very dense set of values, but still. Next problem was studied by Garriga and Corretti 1 year later. And what they said was that actually this problem is there even if you do not care about bulk matter. If you don't have bulk matter, you have still that you want the magnetic flux to be conserved. You don't have magnetic molecules. So magnetic flux is what? It's product of the magnetic field times the internal volume. Now, suppose that you have a phase transition on the brain here. Phase transition changes the base of the deficit angle. Deficit angle changes the volume. But you don't have any way of changing the magnetic field. So you are overall changing the flux. This is impossible. So this means that actually, if you have a phase transition on the brain, the effect is not to change the deficit angle, but just to force the brain to expand if it was, I don't know, if the phase transition goes up or curve into an ADH brain or whatever. But you don't expect just the deficit angle to change as a consequence of this. And this is a very short and nice paper. And as I say, this effect is forbidden by Clarkson observation. And so the only thing that has is that the can happen is that the deficit angle stays constant and the brain curves start expanding. There's actually a second possibility. That is, maybe there is magnetic monopoles. So it's possible that while I have the transition, at the same time, I produce something that is charged under the magnetic field so that on one side, the change in tension changes the angle. And on the other side, this magnetically charged stuff that turned out to be in particular in the form of two brains in the four dimensions, carry out some magnetic charge. And this is a possibility that they discuss in four lines. And this means just that you are admitting two brains in the four-dimensional space that carry out some magnetic charge. And this is nothing but, for the people that are familiar with it, the Brown-Heisenberg phenomenon with two extra dimensions, that is basically a change in the value of the cosmological constant obtained by producing something, in particular in this case, two brains that are charged under some fourth form from the four-dimensional point of view. And so this changes the energy, the overall energy in the fourth form. Or for the people that care about string theory, this is just a very simplified version, probably the most simplified version of the Busse-Bolchinsky mechanism of reducing the cosmological constant. So bottom line is that this football is probably not the best thing for self-tuning, but it's still an interesting example. First of all, again, is that probably the simplest case in which you have a six-dimensional ADD scenario where you have some stabilization mechanism that is taken into account, and I think this is already a good reason enough to study it. And as I said, there is this Brown-Heisenberg or Busse-Bolchinsky mechanism at work. There is one more reason to study two-dimensional brain waves. And is that, gravity, as I was saying, gravity of two-dimensional objects, and actually even larger, is special. And this is just independent of phenomenological applications. So there is this paper, is actually, 1988, Gerald contraction. The paper, I think, has the title of Distribution of Sources in General Relativity. What is their argument? They are saying, I want to find what is the most general source in general relativity that allows me to have well-defined Einstein equations. And by well-defined Einstein equations, they say that they want Einstein equations that are defined at least in the distributional sense. So you don't want stuff like squares of delta function to emerge. You don't want stuff like things that are not square integrable to emerge. But you want, but you allow for also distributional force terms in Einstein equations. And so basically, they studied this, the conditions on the metric that lead to, in particular, a Riemann tensor that is well-defined in the distributional sense. And what they find is that if you have a singular object that has codimension one, like a perfectly infinitely thin codimension one object, everything is fine. You have your nice theory of gravity that works very well. If you go to codimension 2 or more, you start having funny things happening. And in particular, Riemann equation is not well defined in a distributional sense. The reason is basically that, Riemann is made out of second derivatives of the metric and square of the first derivatives of the metric. If you have a codimension 2 object, the metric has a log divergence close to the object. The first derivative goes as 1 over r. The square of that goes as 1 over r squared. And this is not integrable. So not only they study, in particular, this codimension 2 brains. At the time, there were no brains. So they talk about cosmic strings, but that's exactly the same thing. And they find that, for instance, you can get whatever external metric you want by regularizing in different ways the thick brain before sending it to the delta-like limit. And of course, this is different for the codimension 1 case, where the external metric is independent of the regularization that you use. So even worse than that, again, in 2003, when there was this big explosion of interest in codimension 2 stuff, Klein, Giovannini, and Vinay, and other people that I forget and I apologize, and Bostock and Ruth Gregory and other people that I forget and I apologize again, wrote these two papers, finding that there were constraints on the formal method you can put in a codimension 2 delta-like brain. So what did they do? Well, they say, okay, let us study just Einstein equations and then taking the argument by Bostock et al. Let's study the Einstein equations locally close to the brain. So you can write the metric in sort of cylindrical form. You have some radial coordinates, you have some angular coordinates, and then you have your four-dimensional coordinates parallel to the brain, and expand in first order in the distance. And they require this condition of minimal regularity close to the brain. And then they assume that the stress energy tensor is a form of, well, some four-dimensional stress energy tensor localized in the brain, and then zero in the two angular, well, the radial and the angular direction. And what they find, well, they follow the same procedure that we are used to follow when we do, for instance, Israel junction conditions in codimension 1 brains, that is, look for the singular parts in the metric and match the singular parts that come from the Einstein tensor with the singular parts that you are putting in your stress energy tensor. And what they find is, in the end, this condition. They find that the stress energy tensor on the brain is related to some deficit angle, fundamental Planck scale, and induced magnet. And this looks actually like a constraint. It seems like the stress energy tensor on the brain has to be always proportional to the induced metric. And of course, this means that there is a constraint on the kind of metal that I can put on the brain. And it seems that only tension can be localized on a delta-like effect. Of course, this doesn't make sense. This cannot be our world, because in our world, I want to be able to put, you know, pink elephants on the brain and not only a pure tension. And so something has to go wrong here. And again, let me notice that also this argument was already present in this 20-year-old paper of Gerock et al. And they were saying the only condition under which you get the regularization independent result in the limit of the delta-like brain is the case in which the equational state of the brain is the one of a pure tensor. So one possible way out considered by Bostock et al. Is the following. Put higher curvature terms in the 6 dimensions. So that, well, in particular, they are this Gauss-Bonnet term. The Gauss-Bonnet term in 6 dimensions is the only term that you can build with squares of the Riemann tensor that still leads to equation of motion that are only second-order derivatives in the metric. And, well, all the higher terms are classified by Lovelock. And there are more terms emerging like this, and you go higher and higher in your dimensions. So they add this term. And then they, again, they make the same procedure as before. They write Einstein equation, they match singular parts, and they get that there is a new term. You see, this term is proportional to this parameter alpha. There's this new term for alpha g mu nu. That is exactly the Einstein tensor built out of the induced metric. So they say, we have a miracle now, because we have Einstein tensor equal to stress energy tensor. let's say, okay, we recovered four-dimensional gravity, and we are done. And, well, there is this other term, of course, this term is Weyl term, so coming from the bulk, that corresponds to all the stuff that can have out there in the bulk and can gravitate back to mu. But that's pretty much the kind of argument. And, well, I have to say, this is certainly a possibility. There's a huge amount of work, including by people in this room, on Gauss-Bonnet terms in the bulk. That's a perfectly legitimate thing, but still, there is a couple of arguments by which this kind of argument is not completely convincing. First of all, at low energies, you still would like to have a four-dimensional effective theory. This means that you should still want to have a compact space. But now, this compact space is curved. What happens when I put a Gauss-Bonnet term there? I have no clue. I don't know if there are actually solutions or, well, generalization with a Gauss-Bonnet term of the Freund-Rubin compactification of the sphere. In any case, it's going to be a nightmare of a computation. The second question, and this was actually the way the paper was interpreted in the literature. I'm not sure that this was the way the paper was written. Many people read the paper by saying that six-dimensional gravity with a brain doesn't make sense. So this means that you have to put a Gauss-Bonnet term. And you can find papers in which they say, well, you know, Einstein gravity in six dimensions doesn't make sense. That's, again, a very strong statement, and it's, I would say it's a very wrong statement. So the attitude that we took was to be much more conservative. So we keep Einstein gravity in the bulk, and we just follow the idea of Yarok interaction of considering a thick effect. And I would like to underline, we had actually, when we wrote the paper, we had fights. Because, and in the end, we agreed on the fact that we should never use the word regularization in the paper. The idea is that we are not regularizing a thin brain. We are really considering a different system. The idea is that in the limit in which your regularization goes to zero, you expect, in general, some pathology to emerge. And for this reason, we want to consider this thing as a real physical structure in the brain. It's not just a mathematical game. So in particular, we used, we considered one system that we found that was probably the easiest one to study, and still it was very difficult. That was, instead of considering a three brain at the North Pole, we considered the four brain wrap around the North Pole. So what we were looking for, that was our goal, to find a scenario where we have first the possibility of putting matter with arbitrary equation of state on the brain, that was in contradiction with the claims, previous claims in the literature. I mean, it's not claims, it's true that on a delta-like brain, you cannot put whatever you want. We wanted to have a setup where we could control the behavior of gravity in football compactification, because in any case, it's an interesting scenario. It might even have something to do really with the self-tuning or the cosmological constant. Why not to study it in detail and have a well-defined setup where to study that? And in particular, we wanted to understand, this was our very, very initial motivation, and it ended up being one of the things that we did, but not the main one, probably, the understanding of the constraint on the equation of state for the matter localized on the brain. Where does this thing come from, really, physically? So the system that we studied is the following. Again, the outside is the football, as before. The football compactification, I would have just had the point here that would have represented my four-dimensional to brain. Now, we regularize it as a four-brain, so a codimension one object, this one. The interior, at this point, is just a sphere. Of course, it cannot be a football anymore because I'm not putting anything here. So you have a sphere here with some radius. And then you have a football, well, you have some deficit angle effect, as we will see coming from this frame, and you have this football-like configuration here. And I will call theta, this is useful for next future notation, I will call theta this angle going from 0 to pi over 2. Pi over 2 is the North Pole. So just to fix ideas, let us put some numbers. The idea is that this is a good model. For instance, if you are one of those people that like to build the standard model on five dimensions, you have a five-dimensional compact space, so four brains that corresponds to a 4+1-dimensional compact space, living in a bigger 5+1-dimensional space, again compact. Ideally, you can think of having a compactification radius of the big space of the order of the millimeter, this parameter beta, the vertex angle of the order of 1, and starting, so we get the fundamental Planck scale of the order of the TeV, so that you are solving the cosmological, I wish, you are solving the hierarchy problem. And the radius of the brain, physical radius of the brain, is related to the large compactification radius by this condition. This is theta bar is the angle at which the brain is located. Theta bar goes to pi over 2 means the brain shrinking to the North Pole. And one can assume that this thing is also the order of the TeV, so that you have a TeV extra dimension inside the 2 millimeter extra dimension. Gravity can go only in the 2 millimeter size extra dimensions, while all matter can move in this TeV extra dimension, so that people at LHC can look for the excitations in this 4 brain, and people that do modifications of gravity in Washington can look for modifications of gravity looking at the fluctuations on the six-dimensional sphere. So before adding matter, what do we put on the brain? Well, one thing is that we cannot put pure tension on this brain. If you write down the junction condition, it turns out that the stress energy tensor, even before putting matter on the brain, the stress energy tensor that you put on the brain has to have some funny form. In the 4 dimensions that are non-compact, it has to be proportional to the induced matter. So in these 4 dimensions, it has to look like pure tension. However, you can have also stress energy tensor in the phi-phi direction, the compact one. And in this direction, the stress energy tensor has to be equal to 0. And the reason being that, of course there is a difference in the two geometries. And second thing is that the brain has to carry some magnetic charge. The reason is that if you just study the compactified solution inside and outside, you will find that there is a jump in the magnetic field between going in and out of the brain. And this is answers your question about whether this thing is a monopole or not. You need actually to have some electric current flowing around the brain to source a difference in the magnetic field between the inside of the brain and the outside of the brain. So in principle, these are two problems, but the nice thing is that actually this one solves this one. And the way one solves it is to put some brain matter that is charged under the bar Q1. You need to have some electric current flowing around the brain. And the way you do it is to put some brain matter that, again, is charged under the bar Q1. Actually, what one can do is if you consider a scalar field, you can break spontaneously the gauge symmetry on the brain. So what you do, this is your brain action, this is a D5, so this is only on the brain. You put some tension, and then, again, I think this is also things that some people in this room have been working on. You put some charge field, let's say a charge scalar, you give a bet to it, you break spontaneously this symmetry there, and you have still the phase of the field, the Higgs field, or if you want, the Stueckelberg field, the Goldstone mode, or the Stueckelberg field that is still alive there. And this is the magnetic field that comes from outside. Notice that in general, breaking a gauge symmetry doesn't imply that you are generating an electric current. However, in this case, we are breaking a gauge symmetry with a scalar field. The current of this scalar field contains a term that is phi squared a nu. We have a non-vanishing a nu from the outside because we have a non-vanishing magnetic field from the bar. So this generates automatically a non-vanishing current on the plate. And then you write down equations, and it turns out the Maxwell equations determine the value of the electric charge times V. This is the vacuum expectation value of your gauge field, of your scalar field, if you want X field. And then you can determine the position of the brain in terms of the fundamental parameters in your theory. And after setting the brain fields to their value, you can find out that actually you can have that the stress gradient tensor is of the form some component in T mu nu equal to some constant times G mu nu, and T phi phi is equal to zero, as you want. So you generate actually an isotropic, anisotropic stress energy tensors by using this component. And the nice thing is that you can write down the deficit angle for this construction. And this is the expression for the deficit angle. And in the regime in which the thing shrinks to the north pole, so you get to the delta-like codimension 2 object, this corresponds to theta bar goes to pi over 2, you get the correct limit of 1 over beta equal to p4 over 2 pi and 4. That is what you get usually for the two-dimensional frame. So at least this is a consistency check. OK, now we add some matter to the brain in the form of some small stress energy tensor. I'm sorry for notation. I call it again T mu nu. This is not the thing that was there before. This is just stress energy tensor of matter on the top of the brain. And we consider all possible perturbations of this thing. And that is the part that gets annoying, because you have perturbations in the matrix, scalar, vector, and tensors. And you have perturbation in the gauge field. You have this Goldstone mode on the brain. And you have also the position on the brain that can be position dependent. So you have a huge amount of modes. And what you do is to fix the gauge, and you have coordinate transformations and gauge transformations to use to fix the gauge. Solve this Einstein-Maxwell equations in the bulk. Then you kill some modes by requiring regularity at the pole. You kill some other modes by requiring Z2 symmetry at the equator. You kill some other modes again by requiring that the modes are continuous across the brain. And then you have some equations that come from requiring that there is a jump in the brain that is related to the matter content in the brain. So after many months of computation, you get something. Main thing is the presence of this crucial mode. Already in the Randall-Sandler model, we have this very important mode that is a brain-bending mode. This is a scalar mode from the four-dimensional point of view. And it corresponds to, well, the formation of the brain in presence of some matter. And in our case, the idea is that we have this cylinder, and this brain-bending is replaced by a bad brain-fattening mode. The brain can get fatter or thinner in the presence of matter. This is an extra scalar mode. So this is the situation. If you have some matter here around the brain, and incidentally, I'm always assuming that I have a sufficiently low energy that I can neglect Kaluza-Klein modes in this direction, so that I, and the phi dependence is always trivial, in which case the only effect that I can have with matter is to make the whole thing just fatter or thinner. And it's possible to write down equations. And as usual, well, since you have always a scalar source that is the trace of the brain stress energy tensor, the scalar source has to source some scalar mode. And this scalar mode is given exactly by this brain bending. And actually, this is the equation. Notice that in the limit in which the brain goes to the north pole, there is a paper by Gresser and collaborators where they find that there is no scalar modes at all in the theory. So this already tells you that there is something problematic about the theory with the delta-like object, because you cannot have any mode that is coupled to the trace of the stress energy tensor in that case.
Pardon me.
Yes.
It seems that when you perturb the position of the brain,
yeah.
So your angle theta
yeah.
is a function of the four-dimensional coordinates, right?
Yes.
But why it's not the function of the azimuthal angle?
This is my assumption. I'm assuming that I am sufficiently low energies that I'm not exciting anything in the azimuthal angle. I'm assuming that...
But in general, you will do.
Well, the point is, the only thing that I am assuming that the only excitations can come from matter on the brain. Matter on the brain is on a compactified space that is very small. In order to excite azimuthal angle, I need to put in this stuff a lot of energy, because it has to be of the order of 1 over the radius. What I'm looking at is a low, sort of low energy effective theory where between the big compactification radius and the small compactification radius. So, well, answer for your question. And modes are constrained, are constant, sorry, in the phi direction, but they have no trivial direct dependence on phi. And then we limit our analysis to the zero modes only. And after that, Markov also had a lot of time and they did also the computation for the Kaluza prime modes of scalar vectors and tensor. And well, he didn't find that there are no Tachyon modes. That's an important result, but it's not what we are talking about now. What we are talking about now is what does long-range gravity look like? So a distance is much larger than one where R is the competition region. So the result is the same one, if you want, of the paper by Karega and Akka. Basically, you have equations of motion that here I write in this way. So this side I have basically something that describes geometry, induced geometry, dynamics of induced geometry in the brain. And on this side, there is matter and this contribution by this bending mode. And exactly as in the Garriga-Tanaka, so in the Randall-Sandrum scenario, you have actually two interesting things that play one against the other. In the four-dimensional case, you would have t mu nu minus t over 2, where t is the stress energy tensor of the brain. You have 1 over 3 because you are seeing one more dimension. This 1 over 3, however, is cancelled by this, transformed into a 1 over 2 when you take into account the contribution coming from this term, this brain bending mode. So for this reason, the presence of this brain bending mode is crucial if you want to get 4D gravity. And of course, in the limit in which the brain, you can already guess it, the limit in which the brain becomes delta-like, this mode disappears. Because this is related to some fattening of the brain, and of course, for a delta-like brain cannot exist. So this is our starting equation, and then I will write it in a more detailed way. Also, one important thing, what we are interested in the end, is the four-dimensional effective theory. In particular, we need to define what is a four-dimensional effective stress energy tensor that would be the integral of the five-dimensional effective stress energy tensor on this plane, since I'm assuming that the dependence on the azimuth is trivial, is just a trivial integral. So it's just the t mu nu times the circumference of my brain in first approximation. And well, in the end, one can write down at the linearized level the Einstein equations of motion using the induced metric on the brain, and this is what you get. That the Ricci tensor made with the induced four-dimensional metric is given by this stuff. This is exactly what you expect to have usually in the four-dimensional effective, in four-dimensional theory, with a coefficient 1 over the fundamental part scale to the 4th times the volume of the extra space. And this is great, because this is exactly the ADD formula to get the Planck mass at the, in the four-dimensional case, plus this extra term. So what's this extra term? Well, it's given by this expression that we don't really care about. But this extra term, well, as I said, this is standard for the gravity. This extra term corresponds exactly to the stress energy tensor of a Bragg sticky scalar. So we saw that, and we basically freaked out for 1 month or so because I said, oh, we have a Bragg sticky scalar. It means that we didn't stabilize all of the things that we needed to stabilize. There is something going on. There is some modulus that is not stable, and we didn't understand where this modulus was coming from. And as I said, for a while, we thought that we have a scalar tensor theory. And actually, we do have a scalar tensor theory. If you compute how the volume of the extra dimension changes when you perturb the system, you find out that the correction to the volume is proportional to this parameter epsilon. Not only, if you redefine your four-dimensional effective metric, multiplying it by 1 plus epsilon, this term disappears. This means that you are going in the Einstein frame where you have just standard Einstein equations. But of course, you don't want to do that because this is built with a metric that you use really to make your sticks and your clocks. So what's the solution? Well, the solution is that actually this Planck sticky is there, but it's heavy. And it's not obvious in the first place. And then if you look at all the equations that you get, you can find that there is a relation between this mode, epsilon, and the trace of the stress energy tensor. You can write it explicitly. And you can replace it in equations in this form. Now, this term, this function f, that is something I don't really care. It's order one for all values, parameters, reasonable values, so I don't really care about it. It goes in 1 over lambda squared, like this term. It's proportional to the stress energy threshold of the brain, as this term. But then there is this extra thing. It's proportional to the square of the compactification radius, and it has second derivatives of the matter along the brain. This means as long as the fluctuations of the matter on the brain I have a typical wavelength that is much larger than the compactification radius, I can neglect this term. And I'm left with just 40 grams. What does this mean in other words? Well, it's actually something that tells me, well, the transmitization fails when the fluctuations scales on my brain are comparable with the compactification radius. And this is one thing that emerges in many cases.
Sorry, yeah. Are you interpreting this as a mass for the Brzezinski or an effectively large Brzezinski parameter?
I think I'm interpreting this as a mass for Brzezinski.
Okay. Because the form of your stress tensor would still look like that of the scalar.
Yeah. I understand where you want to go. And maybe actually we should talk about it, definitely. My understanding was always this one, that is basically your Lagrangian of Brzezinski is some Brzezinski field times R plus N squared minus N squared I squared. Now, if you put some matter, this matter modifies R, this generates a little bit of a source.
There's another term, right, which is
phi d.
No, I mean, there's a term which is omega phi times, omega times d phi squared.
Yes.
Kinetic term.
I don't know where we should talk about it, actually. It's possible that it could be something like.
Because your analysis was closely related to Gehrig and Tendeka, and in this Randall Sundin story, in the end, what they found was
a lot of friends. Yeah. Well, we should talk about it.
Sorry, if you're able to answer whether there's a massless scale of accuracy, if you try to construct a static solution, you've got like three parameters. Because in the Randall syndrome, the fact that there is a massless scale is because you could put the brain anywhere.
Absolutely.
In the wall, it was a free parameter.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the answer is no.
There's no free parameters.
No. The position, at least, if the brain sticky, and this should be related to the position of the brain.
Yeah.
The position of the brain is not a free parameter. It's fixed in terms of the parameters in the theory.
Then it must be stable.
Yeah. Now, it has to be stable. My understanding is actually of this thing is that in general, well, that was actually a thing that I found out in some other times using some very analysis, system. There was this period where people started to find corrections to the, well, there was this initial question of these rho square terms in the expansion of flow. And then people started studying stabilization mechanisms. And there was a paper by, well, there were several papers, one by the Minneapolis group, or several papers by the Minneapolis group, plus a paper by Chucky, Lisa Randall, Michael Gresser, and John Terning, I think. And they were studying things at the perturbative level. They were saying, okay, let's assume that there is a very strong stabilization mechanism. We don't know what it is, but the forces, the step size of the S-dimension to be fixed. And the perturbative level, they can find what were the corrections to the Friedman equation by imposing that the radius of the S-dimension is kept fixed. And there is still some correction because of the Friedman equation. In any case, some of the work factors changed about. And as an exercise, well, we did the full computation. And it turns out that when the energy, basically when the Hubble parameter becomes comparable with the compactification radius, you develop a naked singularity in the bulk. The reason is there is no stabilization mechanism that is infinitely strong, just because of causality. If you have something that happens very quickly in the brain, it takes a time of the order of the compactification radius for the size of the S-dimension to realize that something has happened. So no mechanism of stabilization can work on timescales that are smaller than the size of the actual dimension. And this is the understanding of what we are getting here. Everything is stabilized, but still there is something that comes out. If you want to force this thing, still you see something funny happening.
You're just saying the mass of this,
The four-dimensional effective theory tends to be that the mass of the branching scalar can never be smaller, larger than the compactification radius. Just by causality. Because this is the time it takes to react. Well, so last question is, what happens in the limit of a delta-like defect? And well, this limit corresponds to theta bar goes to pi over 2. Now, the brain stress and the tension was as before. It was proportional to the circumference of the brain. This was the four-dimensional effective brain stress and the tension that appears on the right-hand side of Einstein's equation, for instance, at the four-dimensional level. This means that when you want to take the limit in which this thing shrinks to the North Pole, you still want to keep T4, so the four-dimensional effective stress and the tension. This means that formally you have to set the T you knew to infinity. That's not a problem by itself. The problem is that there is one mode that is, again, the brain bending mode that is not proportional to T4, but is proportional to the full T. So when the thing shrinks to zero, the full T explodes. And so this brain bending mode diverges too. So this, the best way of interpreting this is that actually this is a strong coupling problem. Basically, you have the kinetic, if you write down a four-dimensional effective theory for this guy, the kinetic term is proportional to cos theta. So that the kinetic term goes to zero when you go to the North Pole. Or if you want to canonically normalize this thing, everything, all this, all the couplings of this guy are suppressed by one over cos theta, and so all the couplings blow up when you go to the North Pole. Unless the trace of the stress-energy tension on the brain is zero. So again, our understanding is that there is a strong coupling problem, that something funny is happening. Notice we are not studying the full theory, we are studying only the theory cut at the level of zero modes. But again, there is something pathological happening, even just at the zero mode, when this radius goes to zero. And conclusions, and then in time. And thank you very much. Well, I would profit actually to ask your feedback if this 2-hour knowledge I could take it away, or if somebody has done these things before, because I'm still wondering. That's the only question I have. Then.
So effectively, you're dealing with four-dimensional one, right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Just with the one-dimension
yes.
circle. So you have what you call this exterior and interior
yeah.
brain. Bulk. Can you get rid? Really need this interior bulk? Can you get rid of it, considering brain as a boundary, for example, or making identifications, if you like, of the opposite, you know?
I think you can.
Opposite circles.
I think you can. You have just to put an appropriate stress and energy test, of course.
No, there is.
On the brain. I mean, you put different stuff on the brain because this, you see, the stuff that is on the brain determines the geometry of what is inside as a function of the geometry of what is outside.
Yeah,
so you have to change the stuff you put on the brain at the background level, not at the level of that.
You also have some magnetic fluxes and that.
Sorry?
You have magnetic fluxes, right?
Yes,
which
yes.
play a crucial role.
Yes, I will have to change the couplings, definitely, but I think I can just do it the other way. Actually, well, when we started working on these things, the first thing we thought about was exactly what you are saying, was a construction like this. And then another copy of the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we got stuck into some technicalities, but I'm pretty sure that the thing works out in the same way also in that scenario.
No, I say you actually don't need the second half. You may consider a brain.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely.
Or
it's you know, putting the second half or not putting nothing, anything is basically the same thing.
So does it make different theory or
I don't know.
You don't know.
I think it shouldn't. At the end, you have a four-dimensional effective theory compactified, everything is under control, you should get at last distances for the gravity. You should have, you will have for sure to change the parameters of the background, so the parameters of the background brain stress energy tensor. But otherwise, everything should be fine.
The interesting thing with that one is that the way you do it, you still have this position of the brain.
Yes.
Whereas they sort of projected out by the Z2 symmetry. So it's not clear. Like everything's just in the
I think you can still say that your modulus is this distance.
Yeah, exactly. But then it's like it's the bulk geometry rather than
you can convert it into bulk geometry, definitely.
Because that you had before as well.
Yeah. As well as the But in the other case, the point was that they could convert it into bulk geometry, but that the North Pole wouldn't have been mapped into the North Pole. Well, in this case, I ignore because there is no North Pole anymore, so I just ignore the issue.
May I ask you another question? You studied a situation where nothing depends on this fire.
Yeah.
At least nothing depends significantly.
Yeah.
On some magnetic field, but probably it's not. You have a symmetry. Right?
Yes.
So perhaps you can integrate over this angle in your original action and compare the result to the Randall-Sundrum situation or whatever, DGP or I don't know.
I'm not sure because of this magnetic field. You see, in one dimension less, in the four-dimensional effective, let's say the five-dimensional effective theory that I have by cutting up this magnetic field, I don't know into what converts, if any.
That will make
so. But otherwise, of course, when you are limiting yourself at low energy modes, you can always get a four-dimensional or five-dimensional effective theory. But
that's what you actually have.
Yes. Effectively, yes. But the point is, this magnetic field, I don't know what it corresponds
because
to in one dimension.
When people consider a dimension one brain,
yeah,
they usually assume that there are extra dimensions, but just complexify it somehow.
Yes, yes.
In your case, you introduce one of them explicitly and deal with it, but still nothing depends on that dimension. In that sense, you may kind of integrate with it.
Absolutely. I totally agree. Modulo this problem of the magnetic field. Because the magnetic field in one dimension less, I don't know what it is. But otherwise, yes. I mean, effectively, we are studying always a one-dimensional problem. We have always this dependence on this parameter theta, all this, the wave function that you write down are only functions of theta. And that's it.
Last question. Yeah. How would you describe cosmology?
Okay, so there was a follow-up paper on this stuff. Again, this was this paper by Marco Peloso students. And they don't do the whole cosmology, but they look for the sitter breaks. And they find that you have a discrete set of possible values of the cosmological constant in the brain that is related basically to this quantization condition. And this corresponds exactly to Busso-Polchinski or Brown-Teitelboy, in which you have a discrete set of values of the cosmological constant that corresponds to different values of the flux, and this is quantized, and so everything is discretized.
I mean, how do you describe expanding universe?
I don't know, but I can tell you how we expect it to happen. If you put some matter on the brain deforms a little bit, space gets a little bit faster, and at low energies you should get four-dimensional effective gravity. At high energies, I don't know.
So will we have expanding bulk geometry or something like that?
No, hopefully not. I would have that bulk geometry back reacts a little bit, but if it was really expanding a lot, it would mean that I am in trouble. It would mean that actually I didn't stabilize and there is a Masters modulus around. And what I expect is that the bulk will back react a little bit, but most of the expansion will happen only parallel to the brains. So that at low energies, well, you see, this perturbation theory is valid also in cosmology at the low energies. Then at high energies, God knows what happens. Okay, thank you.